Thank you, everyone, for coming. Again, I'm Brian Geller. I'm an associate scientist at Iowa State University. And this is definitely very much a team collaborative project we've been working on. I'd like to recognize my co-authors, Rob Annex, Chris Anderson, Ray Arrett, Phil Gassman, Manoj Jha, and Daryl Herzman. Because without them, we couldn't put this big project together. Quick introduction to the hydrologic cycle. We've got our evaporation, transpiration going on, driven by solar energy forming clouds. Those condense into rain clouds. We get rain. Precipitation moves back down on the land. You just keep the cycle going, as everyone knows. As you can see from that slide, you know, the climate, it's inextricably linked to the land cover. And so humans, you know, they've a long time, and numerous times they thought, oh, we could at least modify the climate doing this or doing something else. This has come out a lot more as we've considered geoengineering solutions for climate change. But the most interesting recent kind of semi-large-scale attempt I could find was the establishment of the Nebraska National Forest, where essentially they tried to plant a forest in the Sandhill regions of central Nebraska, and one of the around the turn of the past century, and one of the stated objectives was to ameliorate the environment. And I've driven through Nebraska quite a few times since then, and it doesn't really seem like they really succeeded in ameliorating the environment. Then they currently have problems with this forest that some of the pine trees aren't reproducing, and they planted a 20,000 acre forest and it's not going to continue on unless humans intervene again. But there, you know, there's other ways that the humans have impacted the climate as well, and it's hard to analyze these changes, mainly because we've got to play the hand that we're dealt. It's almost impossible to do an experiment where you want to actually go out and change the land cover over a significant enough fraction of the land surface to make a difference. But there's been some recent research, you know, mainly dealing with humidity and temperature variations that, you know, the large-scale land cover changes we've had due to production agriculture have modified the local environment. A couple of the studies are shown here, one where they were looking at nighttime temperatures in the Central Valley of California. They've increased with irrigation. You got higher greater heat holding capacity with the more moist temperatures, and it keeps the nighttime temperatures up. And then there's similar some additional changes in Illinois that they've documented that in the last 20 years of the 20th century, the increase in row crops has increased the summertime humidity. In this study, they were looking up in northern Illinois and attributing that to the row crop proliferation. We are proposing a fairly large-scale change in land cover in the future. You know, the Renewable Fuel Standard of the Energy Independence and Security Act requires 22 billion gallons of advanced biofuel production, which is typically projected to come from cellulosic crops. And this is going to be phased in by 2022. And this is going to be if this is realized, this will be one of the largest especially managed land scale changes that we've ever seen. And if you look at the biofuel crops that we're going to be replacing this with, they've got a different evapotranspiration temporal profile than the crops they're going to be replacing. If we look at crops such as switchgrass, miscanthus, poplars, they've got longer growing seasons. They're a perennial crop, or perennial crops versus annual crops, so we've got just a longer time period that they're transpiring. And generally, we've either got similar amounts or greater total amounts of evapotranspiration, and it'd actually be a little more similar to the original vegetation in these areas. So we came up with a project where we want to look at these changes in the climate and environmental quality from these land cover changes, and see if there's going to be any impacts from this advanced biofuel production, or are we going to change the climate with our land cover practices. This is where it really shows how large this project is. We start up here with a meteorological model. We're modeling essentially North America plus a couple hundred miles into the ocean, and that's the extent of our model. We've got a land cover model that goes with this with the meteorological model, which as you can see here, we've got radiation, precipitation, temperature, wind coming out of our meteorological model, and our albedo, evaporation, transpiration, heat flux coming out of our land cover model. And to keep things a little easier on our side, this the land cover model is a fairly simplistic land cover model. We've got a 25-kilometer cell size, similar to the same cell size as the meteorological model, and we represent everything with a majority land cover in that 25 kilometers squared. We then feed the output of the meteorological model into the daily erosion project model, where we estimate some water stress, erosion, runoff, soil conditions in the state of Iowa, and we also look at some environmental impacts at using a SWOT model of the Upper Mississippi River Basin. So essentially, this is the coupled part of our model, and this we're driving these two models with the output. It'd just be too complex to actually try and bring these models fully together. Just a little background on how we're implementing the meteorological model. We're using a climate baseline, using the 1979 to 2004 North American Regional Reanalysis data set. It's a data set of boundary conditions of North America, that bounding area I was talking about, North America, a little extending slightly into the oceans. And we have those boundary conditions for 1979 to 2004. We then run a simulation of the model, try and get a baseline scenario, and for 1979 to 2004, and then we applied the land cover change to the NOAA land model, and then we run the same meteorological model using the same boundary conditions. And as I said before, we've implemented this at a 25-kilometer resolution. To drive the changes, we needed to interface with an additional model, and that is the PolySys model run out of the University of Tennessee, where they projected areas where switchgrass would displace pasture land, hay, and some crop acreage in suitable counties across the country. They had some moisture restrictions on where they were projecting switchgrass would grow, and used the USDA data on the various acreages in those different categories at the county level. So then we had to resample the county level estimates to the 25-kilometer grid spacing of the WRF meteorological model. I can show you here, this is a map of the projected fraction of a county in switchgrass in 2022. You can see most of our switchgrass transition. Most of these areas are currently not switchgrass. There's very small portions of switchgrass in these counties, but some of these counties in Oklahoma and Kansas, we're getting up to, you know, a third to a quarter, almost a half of the county being switchgrass. Now we've got varying decreasing levels as you go east in the country, and we've also got some area up here in South Dakota and Nebraska. So as I said before, our meteorological model runs on the majority land cover, so we had to change the parameters in the meteorological model to accommodate this, and we've created some combined classes, because in none of these counties were actually getting greater than 50%, which would be your majority land cover in these areas. So we've had to recode some of the land use in the meteorological model. These land cover classes down here, 23, 25, 26, and 27, were currently not occupied. They were tropical or desert ecosystems that aren't represented within the domain of the model. You can see we've got a lot of switchgrass being primarily grown in this area in Kansas and Oklahoma, with an area that's more grassland or cropland and switchgrass in these more outlying areas. So we've got a very big focus of switchgrass right here. Again, since we created some new vegetation parameter, land cover parameters, we had also had to change the vegetation parameters. We increased the, we maintained a similar rooting zone. We would actually, we think if there you went to a full cover of switchgrass, you probably actually get a little deeper rooting depth, which is our number of rooting layers. We also changed the surface roughness a little bit. These crops are generally projected to be a little bit taller than the crops they're replacing. Otherwise, we pretty much kept most of the parameters the same across there. And then when we get some model outputs, then we're going to feed that into the daily erosion project. As I said before, simulate our changes in water stress, erosion, and then use a SWOT to simulate some of our changes in the environmental impacts. The project at this point is very much still in the preliminary stage. We've got results from our alternative scenario, which is scenario one here on the right hand side, and we have the control simulation on the left hand side. Our model, we like some of the output. We're getting about 35 to 40 inches of rainfall in central to eastern Iowa, which is what we get in Iowa. We've got a few interesting results from model runs through 96. We're still actually completing model runs at this point, but we've got some decrease in precipitation right down immediately downwind of the land cover changes, and then a little further downwind we've got a 1 to 3 inch increase in precipitation. And so we think we might get some interesting results out of our Mississippi River Basin model showing increased precipitation under this new scenario. And our meteorologist working hypothesis on that is that this change in land cover is that we're maybe pumping a little more humidity into the atmosphere there, and it'll actually stabilizing the atmosphere directly downwind right here. But then as you move further downwind, we've added more humidity to the atmosphere, you know, creating a little more energy, and we're getting additional precipitation as you move further downwind. You get an unstable condition where you've got to remove the rainfall from the atmosphere. That's where we're at right now. And if you have any questions or insight, I'd love to hear it.
As you have the land use change, in agriculture.
How do we account for the land use change in agriculture?
In agriculture. Just, well, good part of the Kansas is in.
Yep. The areas we were looking at were not a lot of irrigated agriculture, and the areas that are irrigated agriculture are not going to be changed in our model. Irrigated areas stay irrigated in the polycyst projections. We're only displacing rain-fed crops with the polycyst projections. Thank you.